This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar. Special guest at the KBOO Benefit film showing this evening, Thursday, January 10th at the Clinton Street Theater at Southeast 25th and Clinton. Also speaking at tonight's event will be Carl Wolfson, who recently lost his job as a progressive talk radio host on KPOJ when the station's owner, Clear Channel, decided to pull the plug on progressive talk and turn the station to an all-sports format. The film tonight is Oliver Stone's 1988 classic, Talk Radio.
There, you're part of the problem, you see.
I don't care what you think. No one does.
He's going down in flames, Dan.
The program starts at 7. Doors open at 6:15 at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland tonight. More info at kboo.fm/kboofilms.
KBOO is proud to be a media sponsor of An Evening with Dr. Michelle Alexander, Wednesday, January 16th, 2013, from 5 to 9 p.m. at Emmanuel Temple, located at 1033 North Sumner Street. Dr. Alexander is the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. There will be a community fair, a community panel, and Michelle will read from her book. For more info, go to kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a new report shows that Portland's police chief ignored complaints about misconduct by an officer.
The University of Oregon comes under fire for restructuring its Office of Diversity.
Another school shooting today in California comes in midst of a national debate on gun control.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 10th, 2013. I'm Jen Chavez.
And I'm Joey G. The commissioners of the Port of Portland voted 7-2 yesterday to pay $10 per container to shipping lines in order to keep the port in business. The vote comes during a simultaneous labor dispute and slowdown in productivity, with accusations flying back and forth between the International Longshore and Warehouse Union Local 8 and the port, as well as the company that runs the port's daily operations. Productivity dropped dramatically last July during the onset of the labor dispute, as cargo backed up and ships moved on to competing ports. The port blames the union for the slowdown, while union officials say poor management practices and market fluctuations are the cause. ILWU spokeswoman Jennifer Sargent referred to the payments as bribes and said that the port is scapegoating workers for variation in productivity that are beyond the workers' control. Shippers such as Hanjin of South Korea have welcomed the payments, which will only offset a fraction of the cost of moving a container through the West Coast port. Whatever the cause behind the slowdown in productivity, and whether or not the payments bring in more business, this latest episode further deepens the ill will between the ports and its workers.
Newly released documents show that a nearly unanimous recommendation by Portland's Police Review Board to fire a captain accused of misconduct last year was disregarded by the police chief and mayor. Captain Todd Wyatt was the subject of multiple complaints by female colleagues about sexual harassment and inappropriate touching. Furthermore, he was involved in a 2011 off-duty road rage incident in which he flashed his gun and badge to another motorist who Wyatt incorrectly deemed gang-affiliated due to his appearance and the dark tint of his windows. An investigation by the Police Review Board, an internal body within city law enforcement, found that the accusations held up and that Wyatt lacked credibility in his response to the allegations. They recommended his dismissal with a 5-1 vote, with a vote against by an unidentified board member calling for demotion and suspension. Indeed, on December 31st, Police Chief Mike Reese chose to demote rather than fire Wyatt to a lieutenant position, moving him to a detective division as of last week. Mary Beth Baptista, head of the Independent Police Review Division and a member of the board, told the Oregonian newspaper that, quote, "This is not what police accountability looks like." Chief Reese was quoted by the same newspaper defending his and Adams' choice to demote Wyatt as, quote, "the appropriate measure of discipline." He added that he analyzed the investigation in depth and coordinated with the city attorney's office to ensure consistency with past discipline. Today, I spoke with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch for further analysis of the case. Are the actions of Mike Reese and Sam Adams in the case of Todd Wyatt, would you say they're consistent with the disciplinary history of the Bureau, either in regards to sexual harassment or off-duty road rage incidents?
That's a difficult question to answer because most of the time when discipline is handed down, we don't find out about it. There have been a few high-profile cases over a few years, and usually it has to do with excessive force, where we do find out what the discipline is. And sometimes it has been involving sexual misconduct, but generally those cases are with members of the public and not with other members of the Bureau. So it's hard to say whether it's consistent, but it is troubling that I think it was 4 out of 5 members of the Police Review Board recommended that the Captain Wyatt be terminated, and that the chief and the mayor didn't fire him.
What issues of transparency does this sort of case and this sort of investigation bring up?
Many levels, and I have to say, we've had our concerns about the structure of the Independent Police Review Division over the years. It's been around for 11 years. It's never done an independent investigation. We're a little troubled by the idea of having the director of the IPR sit on the Police Review Board as a voting member, since she processes the cases and can what's called controvert the findings. If the Bureau proposes a finding that she disagrees with, she can say, "I disagree with that," and that triggers the holding of a Police Review Board hearing. So there's sort of a lot of structural issues involved, but her responses to this case are extraordinary and groundbreaking, and we want to see more of this in the future. I mean, this is her response that was printed in the Oregonian today, was that this is not police accountability, and she also thought that it not only was it shocking that the chief and mayor didn't follow the recommendations of the board, but that there was so much redaction going on and things being blacked out in this in the Police Review Board report that came out yesterday, that the public has no idea what's going on. And we agree with all of that. And we would go further to say, we think that these Police Review Board hearings should be held in public, or at least that the media should be able to sit in on them. And if not all of the public, at least the person, if there's somebody in the public that was involved in the interaction with the officer, that person should be able to sit in on these hearings. And right now the rules don't allow for that.
Does this case illustrate need for reform in any other areas besides the ones that you just mentioned regarding transparency and structure you would note?
Yeah, well, I think another thing that Director Baptista raised in her quotes for the Oregonian is that we don't know, and I said this earlier too, we don't know what the outcome is usually in the public. And her comment was that the Police Review Board report should state what the final decision was by the chief, because they can't publish the Police Review Board summaries until the chief has made his final decision. So when this report comes out, that means they know what the final decision was, but it's not part of the report. And if the chief makes a different decision than what the review board suggests, then we should know why. And I think that was a recommendation from the stakeholder group that was called together several years ago in 2010 that was promoting changes to this entire oversight system, and it was one of the recommendations that just the chief said, no, I'm not going to do that.
Thanks very much. I've been speaking with Dan Handelman, who is with Portland Cop Watch. Reporting for KBOO News, this is Jen Chavez.
Emergency calls were made yesterday when two young men walked the streets of Portland's Selwood neighborhood, openly displaying assault rifles strapped over their shoulders. The two men in their early 20s, Stephen Boyce of Gresham and Warren Druin of Selwood, walk near 7th Avenue and Spokane Street displaying their weapons in what they called an effort to educate the public on Second Amendment rights. Mr. Druin has a YouTube channel on which he posts videos of himself walking publicly with his weapon around Oregon and the reactions he gets from police. The two men both had concealed handgun licenses, which precluded them from police action under state law. The state allows cities to choose whether to allow loaded weapons in public places. Portland has banned such possession, but state law supersedes to allow concealed permit holders to be exempt from the ban. Spokespeople for the Portland police have said that while the young men's actions were illegal, they were irresponsible, caused fear in community, and diverted police resources. Indeed, multiple community members called the authorities, and at least one area school was locked down. Penny Okamoto, the executive director of Ceasefire Oregon, spoke to KABU about the problems presented by the legality of such actions.
They were not breaking a law. I don't think they were necessarily exercising responsible gun ownership. But they were not breaking a law. I don't think people realize that this is something legal. I think if people did realize that, they would want that situation changed. I mean, it's ridiculous. But it is nonetheless the law in the state of Oregon that people can carry these weapons completely legally and aren't going to be asked any questions. I think a gun owner needs complete responsibility to his or her community. You know, even in something like speaking, you know, we have the right to freedom of speech, but we don't have the right to do things like yell fire in a crowded theater. And we certainly know that people have the right to walk down the street espousing whatever crazy thought or obnoxious thought that they want to do. But it doesn't mean that it's a good thing to do or a polite thing to do. And really what these people are doing, they say they're trying to educate the public. No, what they're trying to do is intimidate the public. And you know, when people say an armed society is a polite society, that's nonsense. An armed society is an intimidated society. And we're intimidated because we're afraid to go to the movie theater, go to the mall, send our kids to school, because we don't know who has a weapon and who's going to be using it responsibly or not. And in this case, I think pretty much everyone, even some of the forums I've been on, the pro-gun forums I've been on, have said that these guys are not being responsible gun owners. And Ceasefire Oregon is not at all against responsible gun ownership. Handguns, hunting rifles, no problem. We do want to see a ban on assault weapons, which is going to be a semi-automatic and going to be able to fire off 10 or more bullets or rounds at one time without reloading.
That was Penny Okamoto, the executive director of local gun control advocacy group, Ceasefire Oregon.
Another school shooting took place today when a high school student in Taft, California, walked into a class with a shotgun and shot one fellow student and tried to kill others. One teacher suffered a minor facial injury from a stray pellet. The shooting took place on the second floor of the high school science building at around 9 a.m. this morning. The local sheriff says that the 16-year-old boy who was shot is in critical but stable condition. This shooting follows the Sandy Hook massacre in Connecticut in December, as well as the close-to-home shooting incident at Clackamas Shopping Center, also in December. Yesterday, Vice President Joe Biden said that President Obama may use executive action in order to prevent further incidents. Such action may include requiring gun dealers to report when customers buy multiple high-powered rifles and to increase penalties for violating gun laws. The National Rifle Association, or NRA, oppose any executive action, arguing that more guns are required to ensure public safety. The NRA has called for the placement of armed security inside American schools. But gun control advocates around the country challenged that proposal, saying that more guns in schools will simply make the problem worse.
Oh. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Tillicum Wawa at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny, with a daytime high near 38 degrees. The evening will see a slight chance of rain or snow, with lows near 28 degrees.
It's just about 5:16, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
A new fad is sweeping across America's university campuses, and it's seriously goofy. This latest craze is not led by students making a cultural statement, but by top administrators trying to make a corporate statement. It's called rebranding, an attempt to modernize the image of venerable institutions by adopting corporate-style logos, slogans, and other marketing fluff. For example, for 144 years, the University of California has thrived under an official seal featuring a bright star beaming onto an open book with a banner proclaiming, "Let there be light." Straightforward and rather elegant. "But it's so old school," cried the rebranders, "so out of sync with today's market-oriented world, especially now that universities are multi-billion-dollar conglomeratized enterprises run not by academicians but by highly paid executives whose chief role is to charm money out of wealthy individuals and corporate benefactors. Forget light. Let there be money," is the new academic aspiration. Thus, the UC system was rebranded with an abstract U-shaped logo with the letter C subtly burned into it. It looks very much like a logo for a bank. And that's the point, for it's meant to impress money people. As explained by the CMO of UC, the university needed to do a more proactive job in expressing where the university was headed. Yes, and what better way to do that than by resorting to PR artifice and corporate gobbledygook, right? All you need to know about where universities are headed is that their latest administrative fad is to hire a CMO. A what? A chief marketing officer. This is Jim Hightower saying the good news is that students overwhelmingly prefer light to marketing. More than 50,000 outraged students signed an online petition forcing UC officials to withdraw the logo.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
The next report comes to us from our community partners at the Scanner newspaper in Portland. New changes in the diversity office at the University of Oregon have angered many students and community members. Over the winter break, the contracts of three popular administrators were not renewed, and the university decided to restructure the diversity office. Dr. Carla Gary, Dr. Emilio Hernandez, and Dr. Tom Ball have been pillars in U of O's Black, Latino, and Native American communities, respectively. In addition to discontinuing these contracts, the OEI also announced that it would be restructuring its approach to diversity with a new, quote, distributed model. This model would shift accountability on issues of equity, inclusion, and diversity from a sole assistant vice president to the entire university. U of O has had its share of controversy when it comes to diversity. Some buildings, such as Friendly Hall, are named after Ku Klux Klan members who donated to the school, in some cases over a century ago. The Office for Institutional Equity was created in 2004 as a result of settlement in a discrimination lawsuit filed by a former university employee. In the last couple of years, the firing of former U of O President Richard Larvier, who was well-regarded for his outreach to minority groups, and the restructuring of the former Office for Multicultural Academic Success caused a number of student protests. The most recent changes have rekindled many of these tensions. Lily Parker spoke recently on her experience of losing her job at the university in a previous restructuring of departments.
At the same time, Joe Wade, who was a 20-year director of the Office of Academic Advising and Student Services, and let me give him his title, Dr. Joe Wade, African-American, got a call from his reporting line at 4 o'clock one Friday afternoon, and went in and they told him, "Pack your desk you're out of here. We have replaced you. They gave him a little space on the third floor with a computer and a telephone. No title, not even special program. He sat there for 18 months until his contract ran out. Now, Dr. Wade didn't do anything wrong. He just no longer made a good fit. They had appointed a vice president of enrollment without advertising it. And he said, Lily, I don't know if I would have taken that position, but I was qualified. And they didn't advertise it. You see, there's policies and procedures in line. And they didn't follow those policies and procedures. They just appointed who they wanted in that position. And so he initiated a suit. And in his suit, he asked for a position at this institution on the vice presidency level that would be housed by a member of an underrepresented group to be the voice of those people at the higher level of administration. OIED is there because of a lawsuit that Joe Wade initiated and won. When we complained that we were the lowest paid academic advisors on this campus, he commissioned a study of comparable institutions across the United States, and guess what Mr. Ernie Pressman in HR found when the results came back? Academic advisors in the office at that time of multicultural academic support, that unit that served to support self-identified students of color on this campus from admissions to graduation were earning $5,000 to $10,000 less a year than comparable offices on other campuses. Out of that study, Dr. Benson awarded Consuela Zuma Jeffress and Lily B. Parker a raise. Now, we didn't get the $5,000, but we got more than 50 cents. And we tried to ask for it to be retroactive. They didn't want to hear that, but they gave us a raise. And I want you to know that raise is the only time yours truly got her 3% cost of living raise. And at that time we would get 4% merit raise. I have never got a 4% merit raise. I have never, do you understand what I'm saying? I've never got a 4% merit raise. And yet, I've had two vice presidents on this campus say, you know what, Lily? There is not another person on this campus who has retained as many students here as you.
That was Lily Parker, a former administrator at the University of Oregon, where students and community members are challenging the recent decision to restructure the Office of Diversity and cut the jobs of several minority administrators. A thank you goes out to our partners at the Scanner newspaper for that story.
Salem and Eugene were both ranked in the top 15 gayest cities in America today by The Advocate magazine. The Advocate is the oldest and largest LGBT interest magazine in the U.S. The Advocate chose the 15 gayest cities using a ranking system that awarded cities points for categories like number of LGBT elected officials, marriage equality, and transgender protections. The ranking system also awarded points to cities for some more tongue-in-cheek categories like gay rugby, fabulous shopping, and concerts by the cast of Glee. Salem made it to number 14 on the list because of its large number of LGBT-welcoming churches and support groups. Eugene was ranked at an impressive number 7. Eugene got the ranking partially due to the University of Oregon being among the top 20 colleges for LGBT students by the Advocate College Guide, and partially because of Eugene's great counterculture and eco-consciousness. Portland did not make it onto the list.
The Boy Scouts of America have denied an 18-year-old his Eagle Scout status. The reason given by the organization is that Ryan Andreessen, a Boy Scout for 12 years, is openly gay. The organization claims that Ryan is not eligible because he has not complied with his duty to God because his sexuality makes him ineligible to be a Boy Scout at all, let alone an Eagle Scout. The Eagle Scout status is the highest honor that a Boy Scout can receive and involves considerable work and leadership ability. Ryan Andreessen, a model of a true Boy Scout, did a project for the Eagle requirements where he created a tolerance wall that he hopes will bring more awareness to people about the things he had to endure during his time in high school and at scout camp. During these times, he was called a broad spectrum of homophobic names and slurs. He is also a victim of bullying and harassment based on his sexual orientation. The review board for his Boy Scout Council in California voiced support for Andreessen and challenged the national leadership's ban on gay Boy Scouts. They recommended awarding Andreessen the Eagle Scout status regardless of his sexual orientation. The current president of the Boy Scouts of America has stated that he is committed to ending the ban but did not weigh in on Andreessen's case.
According to the Centers for Disease Control, we are in the midst of the worst flu epidemic in a decade. The country is now faced with three flu or flu-like epidemics. The annual flu season started early with an unusually aggressive virus. There has been a surge in a new type of norovirus, and we're in the midst of the worst whooping cough outbreak in 60 years. Widespread influenza is causing many local crises. Boston's mayor declared a public health emergency yesterday. A Pennsylvania hospital was forced to construct a tent to handle flu cases, and New York City flu cases are increasing rapidly. At the same time, a large and early outbreak of norovirus, the cruise ship flu or stomach flu, has been seen in Maine. Whooping cough or pertussis is at its worst in Colorado, Washington, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Vermont. Some political commentators are blaming politicians who have opposed mandated sick leave for forcing Americans to go to work sick, spreading the disease to others. Laura Conaway of MSNBC's The Maddow blog points out that Wisconsin government Scott Walker signed a law in 2011 which overturned Milwaukee's mandatory sick leave. The CDC recommends that people stay home until they haven't had a fever without medication for at least 24 hours.
A new report finds that as much as half of all the food produced in the world is thrown away. The UK's Institution of Mechanical Engineers, IMECE, released a report today finding that up to 2 billion tons of food is wasted each year. The UK institution blames the terrifying figures on overly strict sell-by dates by one-get-one-free deals, demand or cosmetically perfect food, poor engineering and agricultural practices, inadequate infrastructure, and poor storage facilities. IMECE is calling for immediate action to confront this waste issue. Their report, Global Food, Waste Not, Want Not, finds that between 30 to 50% of the food produced around the world never makes it onto the table. Tim Fox, head of energy and environment at IMECE, said that not only could this wasted food be used to feed those in hunger today, but that the production of this food is wasting land, water, and energy resources. IMECE is encouraging governments, development agencies, and organizations like the UN to work together to prevent further waste by discouraging wasteful practices and to change people's mindsets on waste.
In the latest news from Pakistan, two bombs at a billiards hall have killed at least 81 people. Much like recent U.S. drone attacks in Pakistan, the first bomb was followed by a second strike that appeared to target first responders who arrived on the scene. The second strike caused the building to collapse, killing dozens more people who were trapped inside. In addition to the 81 people killed in the attack, at least 110 people were injured. The bombing took place in the Balochistan province, which has recently seen an increase in fighting between Sunni and Shia Muslims. Local police say that they believe members of the Frontier Corps paramilitary group were the targets of today's bombing, although many civilians were in the billiards hall and became victims of today's attack.
And now the latest news and development from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, January 10, 2013. Four injured in the West Bank by Israeli settlers' attacks and tunnels collapse in Gaza due to heavy rain. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Four Palestinian youth were injured on Thursday as dozens of extremist Israeli settlers attacked Palestinian villagers enjoying snow in northern West Bank. Local sources reported that settlers attacked Palestinians playing with snow in Burin village, south of the northern West Bank city of Nablus. At least one resident was injured. Another Palestinian was shot and injured by settlers' fire in the nearby village of Kassara. Two others were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. Residents reported that Israeli soldiers arrived at the two villages and attacked them with the settlers as well. Also in northern West Bank on Thursday, Israeli soldiers invaded the villages of Yamun and Jaba, broke into and seared several homes and kidnapped three residents. Eyewitnesses reported that the army also installed a roadblock at the main entrance of Jaba village, searched dozens of vehicles and interrogated residents. The army kidnapped two Palestinians in the village and took them to unknown destination. In the nearby village of Yamun, the army also broke into and seared several homes and kidnapped one resident. In a separate incident today, Israeli soldiers violently attacked and arrested several Palestinians playing with snow in Sheikh Jarrah in occupied Jerusalem amidst the current snowfall that is covering nearly every part of Palestine. Extremist settlers who gathered in the area shouted slowly.